Good morning. My name is Steve Bernard. I'm going to be presiding over the oral arguments today. To my right is the Honorable Russell Carparelli, and to my left is the Honorable Alan Loeb. Counsel, you are both experienced counsel up here, so I will simply ask, first you, Mr. Cherner, have you received our one-page set of directions for oral argument?
Yes.
And do you have any questions about that?
No.
Mr. Lee, how about you? Thank you very much. The one last thing I shall say before arguments begin is that we would greatly appreciate it if folks would be so kind as to turn off or put on vibrate any electronic telephones or paging devices that might go off and interrupt the council while they're making their arguments. That being said, Mr. Cherner, please proceed.
Good morning. I am Philip Cherner, and I have the honor of representing Mr. Edwards. I'll be brief. If I could, I would like to focus on what we think is the controlling issue in this case, the unfiltered expert testimony offered by two witnesses presented at trial over vigorous defense efforts to first obtain discovery, assert the right to a Shrek hearing, and then over objections during the trial. When the court determined that the evidence was, in fact, in the court's view, not expert testimony. We believe it rises and falls on the test set forth in the Varin case, and that is whether or not the witnesses relied on specialized knowledge and training. Briefly recapping what the doctor testified would therefore, we think, be of assistance to the court. The doctor testified she was a developmental pediatrician, which means in addition to being an MD, she had particular training and skill in developmental issues, as she explained them. She repeatedly referred to various protocols. The one that was critical to her testimony was the protocol relating to whether or how a child is examined before or after 72 hours have passed since the claimed injury. In this case, it was beyond the 72 hours, so she examined using that protocol. She used something called a coldoscope, and I apologize if I've butchered the pronunciation of that, which allowed her to photograph genitalia. She took a culture which she used to check for STDs. She used phrases like vascularity, labia major, vaginal opening, hymen, shape and color. She just spoke normal and abnormal anatomical findings and describe what those would mean. She talked about the anus and reflexes related to it.
Mr. Cherner,
yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question about the doctor's testimony. Why does any of that matter here if because the defendant, as I read the jury verdicts, was acquitted on the two counts where there was alleged penetration. The other counts were just touching counts and there wasn't any injury. So why does the doctor's testimony that you're concerned about matter?
I don't think that testimony was limited to internal examination. At least I don't think the jury would have heard it that way. The testimony, in effect, buttresses the credibility of the only witness that mattered in this case, which was the child. Remember, if I may, remind the court that these cases are prosecuted, and this case is a perfect example, by the testimony of the child, which is then repeated through the testimony of others who heard the testimony of the child, and then the jury is shown a video of the same statements by the child. Anything that buttresses the child's testimony, directly or even inferentially, becomes hugely important because the jury bases its decision in large part upon the child's testimony. Although in this case, unlike some others, there were two defense witnesses who talked about the bias of other witnesses. But there are no eyewitnesses, there are no physical findings other than what we've talked about here. And therefore, it's vital that the court look carefully at anything that buttresses the child's testimony. Also, as I started out in answering your question, I don't think her testimony was limited solely to internal examination. At least I don't believe the jury would have heard it that way. And finally, I think this court has some obligation to enforce the rules that are so carefully written regarding experts? I mean, what else could the defense lawyer have done here to get discovery of this and to enforce the defendant's rights? What's not in the record, of course, because of the government's inability to candidly describe its coming expert testimony, was the defense opportunity to present their own expert or to critically evaluate the expert testimony that was placed before them. I think that's an additional but not the sole reason why the doctor's testimony is vital to this case.
Let me skip ahead. I know you want to talk about the forensic interviewer, and I do too, but I have a specific question about that.
Certainly, Your Honor.
The parties spent a lot of time, and justifiably so in their briefs, talking about the Tillery case with respect to the multiplicity issue. Nobody mentions it with respect to the issue of forensic interviewer. And in fact, there is a section in the Tillery opinion relating to forensic interviewers.
Yes.
Can you tell me why this case should be governed by Varon rather than the way the division in Tillery handled the forensic interviewer there?
Because the defense made aggressive efforts to discover the experts, filed a pleading that specifically labeled the forensic interviewer by name and asked whether that person would be presented as an expert, was told they wouldn't. Varon has a paragraph that details the importance of the defense proactivity in that regard. I think that differentiates us from Tillery. Also, as you know, each of these cases rises and falls on the actual testimony of the individual and how it relates to the other evidence. So I think there are some small distinctions, which, as I stand here, I can't articulate for you, between the specific testimony in Tillery and the specific testimony here. And then there's the cumulative issue of the two experts being withheld from the defense, I guess is the best way to put it. Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. If I may interrupt, I'd like to ask a question about the forensic interviewer and whether the forensic interviewer was indeed an expert. And I couch it in these terms. Aside from vocabulary, like use of words like sequencing, what did the forensic interviewer testify to that a parent of several children or a school teacher or a very experienced babysitter would not be able to testify to?
A couple things. First, under Varon, the key thing is whether she relies on training and training and I forget the other word, education. She testified that she has taught locally, nationally, and even internationally in her field. So she has expertise. She meets that prong. As to what she said that matters, it's both the vouching, which we briefed up hopefully precisely for the court, and also her comments about that played into why the child would change her version of what happened or add things between the first and second interviews. We think that's important. And again, played against the backdrop of a case where we have nothing but the child's allegations and the defendant's statement in the record where he denies any improper conduct, small pieces of evidence become more important.
But again, how would this person's testimony differ from a parent who is familiar with children changing stories or adding or subtracting?
By couching in quasi-scientific terms, as she did. I believe that's the difference. It is the government's burden as the proponent of evidence, which is expert testimony, to pour that evidence through the filter of Rule 701 and 702, and it's the trial court's burden to enforce that. Burden may be the wrong word. Duty is probably the right phrase. The fact that neither of them didn't shouldn't boomerang back on the defense through the argument that, well, it's really just lay testimony anyway. The defense did everything that I can think of under the law and the rules that govern these proceedings to ferret out possible expert testimony and assert their rights. And the government managed to keep a blanket over it until it was testified to in front of the jury, when it was really too late to do much more than renew their continuing objection. I think I've pretty much covered what I wanted to do on that issue. I'll just talk briefly about the failure to instruct the jury on the phrase prior regarding a number of these counts. As best I can tell, that is an element. The Golston case is the closest on its facts, although it's a little different because, although it was, seemed to have been raised on a failure to instruct on an element issue, there are some passages in the court that, in the ruling, that make it look like the court was analyzing it on a failure to present evidence of the element. But in any event, in Golston, they found it was plain error to fail to instruct on that phrase prior.
Let me ask a question about that.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And Mr. Lee, you can listen to this because I'm going to ask you the same question. So on the pattern offenses, he's charged, tried on 7 of those. He's acquitted on 2, found guilty on 5, as I understand it.
I think that's correct, although I manifest some confusion in trying to sort all this out.
So, and all of the acts supposedly took place within like a 6-month period, late December 2000, I think it's May of 2001. So on the 5 counts that he's convicted on, it seems to me that, and there it seems to be clear, they're distinct counts. So why is the failure to instruct on the use of the word prior, why does it have any bearing on 4 of the convictions? Because on 4 of them, 1 had to precede another one. It's the 5th one. Whatever was the first one that I don't get why there's a pattern, and if that's the case, what do we do about it? I mean, it seems to me there's 4 of them where there's harmless error. It didn't matter.
Well, I think the defendant has a constitutional right to have the jury make that decision, not this court and not the trial judge. And that's where that argument leads, Your Honor.
But on the Honeysett case, if they all took place within the defined period and they were all less than 10 years prior to, as to 4 of the convictions, I still don't understand why it matters.
Right. And I think I can't add much more than what I said. I think the jury has to be properly instructed so the jury can make the determination. And that's the best argument I can give you. I would reserve any other time for a rebuttal, lest the court has any other questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. You've got about 3 minutes and 50 seconds, a little bit over.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee, bar number 38141, on behalf of the people. I'll start by trying to answer your question, Judge Loeb. Kyle and Honeysett, I think, present the 2 most analogous cases here. In both those cases, this court held that all that needs to be shown for pattern of abuse is, quote, pattern of abuse is established where there is sufficient proof that the defendant committed at least 2 discrete acts of sexual contact against the same child within a 10-year period and with the period alleged in the information.
But in both of those cases, you only had 1 pattern count.
Indeed.
Here you have several.
Yes.
And they're all, once they get to the jury, they're all identified by the predicate charge is identified by a very specific act. And I know that this morphs over in the multiplicity issue a little bit, but I still don't get why whatever the very first one is, and we don't know what the first one is, where's the pattern enhancer to that first act?
Let me give you 2 answers. First, I don't know if case law is clear at this point whether the first act can be enhanced by a subsequent act. I don't think we have a case dealing with whether that's true or not.
Well, you have a statute now that says that, but you didn't back then.
Yes. Under the prior language of the terms, it's when we compare the 2 statutes, there's 2 ways we could read the change in the change between the 2. One is that it extends the period. So it's now 10 years before and 10 years after, which would mean in this case, the very first act could be enhanced by the second. If, however, it's read as the prior requirement there had been a predicate, so 1 sexual assault count that cannot be patterned, then I agree with you, Judge Loeb. Under that interpretation, 1 would have to become a regular sexual assault, but the other 4 patterns could remain.
But, okay, so if that's the result, which one do we pick? How would we possibly know which one needs to be vacated back to the grade of felony that's the lower grade? How would we know?
Well, in looking at your instructions, I think if we look at the prosecutor's argument, he specified what he thought the first act was. I think, as I stated in our answer brief, the first act, he argued to the jury, was the touching of the butt in the car. And then he said, if you find that act and any other subsequent act, that's a pattern. So if the court was going to go with that latter interpretation, I think the very first count would be the single, and the remaining four counts would remain patterns. And under the analysis of Honey and Golston, the other counts, it would absolutely be harmless. The victim here was under 10 years of age. Necessarily, they were within 10 years. As the jury also had unanimous finding that there's two counts for each of the patterns, by absolute necessity, one of those counts had to be previous to the other. So if the court is going to go with a lot of interpretation, I think the first count becomes a single, but the remaining four counts are patterns. Turning to the doctor's testimony, I think two points for emphasis. One, it didn't rise to the level of expert testimony, and two, if it did, it certainly was harmless in this case.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Lee. Let's assume for purposes of argument that we were to conclude that both those witnesses were experts, okay? I want you to tell me why their testimony is harmless in this case, where, as Mr. Turner points out, the only witness to the events is the child.
Absolutely, Judge. The defendant's principal complaint, I'll separate these two out, but especially with the doctor, is that she provided evidence that we normally don't see sexual assault injuries more than 3 days after sexual assault. So that goes strictly to injecting this issue about explaining the absence of a physical injury. Now, in the context of this case, most of the assaults we're talking about didn't really involve the type of contact we would consider as causing an injury. I think the best that could be said is, as Judge Lowe pointed out, the one count about the defendant's penis touching the victim's butt was the only one we could think of which would actually may have caused an injury. All the rest only dealt with touchings, and the defendant was acquitted of that one count. So taking the evidence here, I don't know how we can establish any prejudice. Moreover, I would strongly distinguish this case from Varin. In Varin, the case, the disputed evidence went strictly to the material disputed element in the case. Here, this evidence wasn't affirmative evidence to any of the elements in the case. It was just merely explaining the absence of something. And again, as I definitely want to emphasize, it was an absence of something that maybe didn't even need to be explained at all, considering the things the defendant was convicted of and the allegations that were alleged in this case.
But doesn't the forensic interviewer's testimony go to the very heart of whether these events happened or not? I mean, isn't she testifying that she was trained in how to conduct interviews to find out what happens? And she goes on at great length with all these scientific terms about this is why I do it this way and this is why I do it this way, all to, I suppose, establish that in fact these events occurred. Why isn't that going to the very heart of the case?
2 points on that. First, I think most of the statements you're talking to happen in rebuttal. And as I argued in the brief, I think the defense opened the door by attacking the investigators or the forensic interviewer's investigation in the case. So I think under that standard, the defendant invited and opened the door to most of the stuff that you're talking about. Second, I would agree with you that the case for harmlessness is more troublesome with the interviewer than it is with the doctor. But the flip side of that is I think it's very clear that the forensic interviewer's testimony here did not rise to the level of expert testimony. Although I think it's arguable that maybe the doctors did, the forensic interviewer's testimony definitely didn't. Everything she described was completely based on her own experiences, just what she had seen based on her own experiences. It went nowhere beyond just things she had observed. That does not depend on a reasoning process that's not used in everyday life. It wasn't based on any specialized.
Let me ask you about that. If to the extent that the forensic worker said the young girl said this to me, then that would be her observation, her auditory observation. To the extent that she would say, in a previous case I observed this, that would be her own observation. But what happens when she generalizes and says, based on my experience, and then goes on, and speaking generally about children in general or sexual assault victims in general, isn't she then forming an opinion based on her experience, based on her observations?
I think Rincon and Tell Whiteman tell us no.
Say that again?
I think Rincon and Tell Whiteman, those two cases, tell us no. In both those cases, we're dealing with very similar facts to what we have here. especially in Rincon, the officer testified that based on his experience, he had seen lots of photo lineups and lots of defendants invoke their Miranda rights. He then made general assertions based on those specific observations. This court found that that same reasoning process was one familiar to everyday life. At its core, it was still tied to his observations.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit on that. In Rincon and Tall Whiteman, the police officers talked about their prior experience. In Barron, the police officer specifically tied his opinions to specialized training he had received. Now, this forensic interviewer, she's all over the transcript in terms of saying, I had training on this, this is where I learned this, now I'm going to tell you about this particular protocol. Why doesn't that make this case much more like Barron than either Rincon or Tall Whiteman?
Because none of her opinions, I think the critical distinction whenever we look at each piece of the testimony is what was the nexus between the testimony that was offered and the reasoning process behind it. Was it more a restatement or an inference on just observation, or was it more in line with a specialized understanding and then an application? I think Barron falls in the latter category. In this case, doesn't quite rise to that level. I'd also support this point, as this court mentioned, to the Tillery case, as well as the Gillespie case. We have very similar testimony, and yet it wasn't found to have been reversible in those cases.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Lee, but I asked Mr. Turner about the difference between this witness and, a school teacher or a parent. And Judge Loeb has suggested one difference. There may be some specialized training here. Is the training truly specialized based on what we see in the transcript, or is it simply a repetition of what a parent or teacher would know?
I think I would argue that it's simply a repetition of what a parent would know. Although she had different degrees, again, it still goes to the same basic knowledge that a typical ordinary layperson might know. And again, I don't think the fact that a witness talks about, you know, their experiences or what kind of degrees they have, that doesn't necessarily transform lay testimony into expert testimony. I mean, the key distinction always is what's the reasoning process behind it, not necessarily how educated or what degrees the witness has. In switching the 702 we have now from what it was, I mean, I think that was the change in the statute or the rule, was that it really just turns on the testimony and the process used to get there, as opposed to whether or not someone does or does not have certain degrees.
Would an ordinary layperson know the difference between what a core detail is and a non-core detail, and why it's important when you're interviewing a alleged victim of sexual assault, how to use those two things? Quite candidly, I'd never even heard of those two terms before I saw this case.
They might not be familiar with the terminology, but I think based on someone who was in a similar, who observed similar things, they easily could have reached that position without her same training. I think that's just the best way to frame this case. If you take a layperson, you don't give them the specialized training, you have them have the same observations that this person had, they could have easily relayed what they said. Here we're not dealing with, it was more a restatement of information than it was anything else. Additionally, I'd like to point out that despite the defense's suggestions on appeal, they never requested a continuance below. The trial court was pretty adamant that although it wasn't going to order witness preclusion, it would consider other sanctions. So to the extent that the defendant was surprised or maybe prejudiced by this, we would expect that they would have requested a continuance below. And I think under Weygaard, their failure to do so discredits any claim of prejudice here.
How would requesting a continuance do any good? The jury had been selected. They didn't know about this until either one of these witnesses got up on the stand, and by that time you were already in at a minimum to the third day of trial. How could they request a continuance at that point?
Well, I think they definitely could have requested a continuance if they wanted to. They could have, if they wanted other witnesses, or if they truly were surprised. I think that the defense strategy could have requested a continuance in order to do so. I think as the trial court made the findings, the defense was aware of this information well before trial. They weren't surprised by it. That's why I didn't request a continuance.
Well, how long a continuance? What if they want to go out and hire an expert, have the expert review the testimony of, I mean, that could take weeks, months, right?
It could. And in that case, if after requesting the continuance, they arrived at a position where it would have been untenable to have continued the trial, they could have asked for a mistrial.
The issue before us, it seems, is whether the court heard, whether this was expert testimony and whether the court heard. The question of whether they could have asked for a continuance, what does that tell me about whether there was any error?
I think it tells you whether there's any error in the context of the defense's representation that even if the defendant wasn't prejudiced, this court needs to enforce the rule. So I think in looking at whether the error was harmless, the fact that he requested continuance strongly supports that the error here was harmless.
So if I understand correctly, you're saying that we should conclude that there was no prejudice to defendant because truly if the defendant felt prejudiced, the defendant would necessarily have asked for a continuance?
Essentially, but we do have case law supporting that. I mean, Weigart says that in instances somewhat like this, the defense's failure to request a continuance discredits a later claim of prejudice, just because it could be remedied. Because if we think about this case where it would start from the beginning, had the people endorsed these experts, I don't know what the defense would have changed. I mean, with the doctor, I don't know if they would have actually called someone to say, there is evidence of injuries when we're dealing with a case when there's really no reason to believe that there are any injuries to begin with.
Well, but we're speculating. We don't know that. Isn't that the defendant's whole point? You put us in a position where we couldn't even make that choice because we were led down this path, and then all of a sudden we got blindsided by what we call, at least, what defense calls opinion testimony.
And I respond two ways. One, I don't think the record supports they're blindsided, again, by the fact they didn't request a continuance. And two, the issue was so collateral, especially in the doctor's respect, that it just didn't affect the verdicts in this case. And if the court has no further questions, I ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Responding to the last comment, let's not forget that the trial judge said to the government at the pretrial hearing on the expert motion, which was a very routine discussion, the government's telling me they aren't going to have any experts. If they do, that'll be at their peril. We'll deal with that down the road. The defense had every right to rely upon that. I wanted to also bring to the court's attention, right after the Curtis advisement, the trial court found regarding Ms. Perry, the forensic interviewer, that she did testify to training and experience to a considerable extent, both in direct and cross-examination, and a little bit on redirect as well. And I apologize for quoting that to the court, but I'm not sure I cited that page 61, volume 6, the second transcript of that volume. So I'm providing that to you at this point in time. Unless the court has any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Mr. Lee. We appreciate your arguments very much today. The arguments are concluded, and a opinion will issue in due course because the case is now deemed submitted. Thank you very much for being here today, and have a good day.
All rise. Court will be in recess, subject to call.